Hi, this is Tess Taylor, and I'm delighted to have the chance to talk to Matthew Zapruder, class of 89, a Russian major, who is the author of three collections of poetry, most recently Come On All You Ghosts from Copper Canyon, which won a bunch of prizes, the Goodreader's Choice Award for Poetry. It was one of the top five books of poetry from Publishers Weekly, as well as the 2010 Book List Choice Editor's Choice for Poetry. And he is also a co-translator from the Romanian and has a fascinating background in the Russian language and Slavic languages. And his poems, essays, and translations have appeared in many publications, which writers would aspire to, including Open City, Bomb, Slate, American Poetry Review, Tin House, Harvard Review, Paris Review. The list actually goes on for a long time. So, hi, Matthew. It's great to talk to you.
Hi, Tess. It's great to talk to you, too.
So, we're here today to talk about Come On, All You Ghosts. And I thought I'd start by asking you to read one of the poems I enjoy from that collection, which is The Prelude.
Sure. I might say just a few things about it before I get started. Many Amherst grads who took English courses while at Amherst will recognize that the title of this poem is taken from Wordsworth's famous long poem, The Prelude. And the first line of my poem actually emulates Wordsworth's first line, which is, Wordsworth is, "Oh, there is blessing in this gentle breeze," and then goes on to talk about a lot about the natural world and landscape and perception. And Wordsworth is, I'll just say quickly, that Wordsworth in contemporary poetry is less valorized than his compatriot Coleridge. Coleridge was sort of the original of the more personal poem, the more familiar, you know, kind of I-centered psychological experience poem that resembles more closely contemporary American free verse. So I thought that I would try to spend a little time with Wordsworth. And when I did, I realized that he has his own incredible virtues, his music and intelligence and syntax. So anyway, this poem was written after spending some serious time with The Prelude. And there's quotes from Wordsworth in it. So, okay, The Prelude. "Oh, this Diet Coke is really good. Though, come to think of it, it tastes like nothing plus the idea of chocolate. Or an acquaintance of chocolate, speaking fondly of certain times it and chocolate had spoken of nothing. Or nothing, remembering a field in which it once ate the most wondrous sandwich of ham and rustic chambered cheese, yet still wished for a piece of chocolate before the lone walk back through the corn, then the darkening forest, to the disappointing village and its super creepy bed and breakfast. With secret despair, I returned to the city. Something seemed to be waiting for me. Maybe the chosen guide, Wordsworth wrote, he would, even were it nothing better than a wandering cloud, have followed, which of course to me and everyone sounds amazing. All I follow is my own desire, sometimes to feel, sometimes to be at least a little more than intermittently at ease with being loved. I am never at ease, not with hours I can read or walk and look at the brightly colored houses filled with lives, not with night when I lie on my back and listen, not with the hallway, definitely not with baseball, definitely not with time. Poor Coleridge, son of a vicar and a lake, he could not feel the energy, no present joy, no cheerful confidence, just love of friends and the wind taking his arrow away. Come to the edge beckoned softly. Take this cup full of darkness and stay as long as you want and maybe a little longer."
Thank you. So it's so interesting that you began your prelude to this prelude by talking about many of the literary references that we may or may not get, depending on how well we are steeped in, you know, Wordsworth and Coleridge. But I wanted to ask you about beginning the poem with the Diet Coke, because a Diet Coke is kind of, well, a very ordinary object, I could say. And maybe it's a transmogrification of, or translation of something ordinary that Wordsworth or Coleridge might themselves have been drinking. But did it feel does it feel strange to you to start a poem with something like a Diet Coke? I mean, something you can order at McDonald's or maybe Amherst students are drinking right now to study for finals. And
sure they are. No, it doesn't feel strange to me. It definitely feels like a noticeable decision. It's obviously, there's a kind of initial sort of humorous aspect to, you know, redoing Wordsworth's line, but with instead of Breeze talking about Diet Coke. But I actually wasn't trying to be funny when I wrote it. What I was thinking about was, when you read a lot of the Romantic poets, and this is, you know, you don't have to know a lot about poetry to know this. Poets of that time, 19th century poets, wrote a lot about nature. And for them, nature was an everyday presence in their lives. And for them to look at a lake or a mountain or fields or a forest or whatever, those things were sublime to them and wondrous and full of mystery, but they were also very present in their everyday. And for me, I live in the middle of the city. There are trees around, but there aren't, you know, I don't have the same relationship to nature that those poets did. So I was trying to think about what for me would be an ordinary object that when contemplated might lead me deeper into my own life and our lives and, you know, what we actually experience instead of writing about natural things that are important to me but aren't exactly important to me or present to me in the same way they would have been for those poets, if that makes any sense. So when I'm looking at my desk and thinking about writing a poem, my eyes alight upon a can of Diet Coke, and I think, wow, that's something that I see all the time, and it is a kind of amazing object. That substance is an extraordinarily weird and interesting substance that we put in our bodies, and the can itself is kind of amazing, and all the effort and technology that's gone into making it and getting it to us is very, I think, worthy of contemplation, and I decided to try to get my mind in that space in relation to that object. So that's just maybe a complicated way of saying I just wanted to write from my own experience. And then, you know, you write the line and you think, oh, yeah, that's kind of funny. But it wasn't just to be funny, you know, if that makes sense.
Well, I actually couldn't keep from laughing when you read the line about the super creepy bed and breakfast. That seems like it probably was designed to be funny.
Yeah, I mean, I do find bed and breakfast super creepy. I don't remember exactly. I mean, I think that I was thinking about, I think for some reason my mind thought again about, for Wordsworth and Coleridge, and they would go on long walks. They would walk for 10 or 20 miles. They would go on walks for days and days and days. And for them, going on a walk was like a you know, that was a major part of their lives. For me, when I might go for a walk in the countryside, that might be something I might do as part of a vacation. So I guess I think I was trying again to think about how these things function or appear in our own lives. So it just was easy for me to imagine, you know, that you would go on some kind of rustic country walk and then go back to your bed and breakfast. And, you know, I mean, I myself have done that. So I just think that just sort of happened. And then my general reaction to bed and breakfast is that, wow, I mean, the whole experience is a little bit odd at best and creepy at worst. So, it's funny. I mean, the word super creepy is funny. It's fun to say.
The word super creepy is funny. In a really actually genuinely positive review for the New York Times, David Orr commented that you're one of the very, he said something about that very few poets are willing to dare banality. And he said, you know, it was a review of you, and you were the poet who was willing to dare to be banal. And he said that you dared to be banal in a way that was successful. How did that feel to get, I mean, what did you think of that
You know, I think actually I know what he means. I think what he means let me back up for a second and say that, you know, poetry has a reputation for being a highfalutin art, fine art. You need expert training to understand it. You know, it's all about fine feelings and epiphanies and you know, and I think whatever, you know, there's some truth to that. But I think that for me, I am interested in how poetry is part of and interacts with and deepens and complicates our everyday lives. So in that sense, I am interested in the banal, in the sense of the everyday, the things that we encounter. So I take that I think it was a compliment in the sense that I don't feel the need to prove that I'm a cultured, intelligent person at the expense of writing about things like Diet Coke. And if people want to call me, you know, not a real poet or something, or not cultured enough or whatever, then I will accept that as the price I pay for writing poems for everybody, including myself. You know, I'm willing to accept that. You know, so in that sense, I believe that was a compliment in the review, and I took it as one.
Or I mean, I think also it was a sense that it's kind of, at least from David Orr's perspective, it can be hard to put a Diet Coke in a poem and at the beginning of a poem that's sort of a tribute to Wordsworth and have it come off. So I think maybe it was a compliment that is something that I think people try to do, you know, to speak. I mean, the whole history of poetry is a little bit about speaking in common speech, or Dryden was trying to speak in common speech, and William Carlos Williams was trying to speak in common speech. And the question is, do you do it in a way that somehow works? Because
I mean,
we could definitely have good poem with a Diet Coke in it, or a bad poem with a Diet Coke in it.
Well, you're right. As I was giving my answer to your last question, I was thinking to myself, I really don't want to make this sound as if I came up with this big idea of writing about the everyday life or the real world or using common language. Certainly, it's Wordsworth and Coleridge were doing that in the lyrical ballads. In that sense, I find myself very much in a tradition. You know, I think that right now we're in a period of time when a lot of people are trying to do this in different ways, bring all sorts of different language into poetry in different ways, and that's what makes it an exciting time. I think part of it is the more you write, the more words, different types of words you can use in poems. It's funny how, like, with poetry, this is somehow still an issue when it isn't an issue in painting or music or, you know, other forms of art. It's just taken for granted that the whole world can be brought into a painting or to a piece of music or song lyrics or all sorts of other things, yet poetry is damned with faint respect, I guess I would say, fighting old battles. I just tell a little story about that, which is I was teaching at NYU, and my students, who were wonderful, and they were, you know, they were 15 years younger than I was, and really cool, you know, like, dressed great, and going out every night in New York, and these hip kids. Someone brought in a poem that used the word YouTube in it, and most of the students reacted with a kind of horror, like, you can't use that word in poetry. That word doesn't belong in poetry. And I looked at them and I thought, I should be saying that and you should be laughing at me. You know, I should be the old fuddy-duddy. And I said, you have to stop writing like 80-year-old men who live like in the forest. You know,
right.
You live in New York. Write about things you see. Write about the things that happen to you. You know, and that's what I try to do, and that's what I think people should do.
So I'm going to keep talking about William Carlos Williams just because I have happened to be reading tons of him lately, like, devotedly. And one of the lines that he came up with, and I think one of his earlier and arguably less good poems, was, how shall I be a mirror to this modernity? And that kind of project that, well, I have to say what's in front of me and the words that are useful to me and my landscape now. And, you know, for him, it was the poor and the people that he was being doctors to and the New Jersey suburbs that were getting slightly ruined by that exact turn away from nature that you were just discussing. And I'm just wondering, like, if you feel in your poems that there's a kind of a moment that you need to address. And you're sort of getting at that with the Diet Coke. But what is it that you think we need to let in, most importantly? I mean, is this a special moment for letting things into poems?
That's a good question. I don't know if that I would say that there's anything particularly different about this moment, except in this way. Wallace Stevens talks in his great essay, The Noble Rider and the Sound of Words, about one of the things that poets do in their poems is they resist the pressure of the real. And I've been talking about how important it is to me to get everyday life and everyday language into poems, but I think an equal part of what poems do is to create a space for dreaming, contemplation, Whitman would call it loafing, looking at clouds, contradiction, all these things. And I think that our public discourse has really gone in the direction of a rhetoric that is extreme, one-sided, not related to the actual feelings that people have on an everyday level, which creates a big space for all kinds of art that have to do with language, you know, but particularly poetry, because our language is it's regularly violated as public discourse. So there is a space for poetry to not to stand up and say, oh, you know, Republicans are bad or Democrats need to do this or whatever, but to say this is life as we know it and as we live it. What John Boehner or Barack Obama say, agree or disagree, that doesn't feel connected to my experience of life. And so in that sense, I think a public space has opened up. I don't know, you know, I'm alive at this time. I wasn't alive before 50 or 100 years ago, so I don't know whether it's worse or better now. But it's, for one thing, the language is so public because of the internet and all the availability of media constantly in our lives. So I think that it's harder to, I know for a fact, it's harder to find a space where you're not being assaulted by whatever is happening in the media. So a book of poems is an even more precious thing right now.
I wonder if that kind of relates to a sort of uncertainty I wanted to ask you about in your poems. I wanted to quote a few lines from various poems. One is, you were born to feel a way you don't have a word for, and all they really know is it was dirty, and that's describing the past. And today, the unemployment rate is 9.4%. I have no idea what that means. And each of the faiths of our various fathers helps us only partly. And, of course, in the prelude, there's this line that says, all I follow is my own desire. So it seems like in this Come On All You Ghosts, which is a great book, congratulations, there's a lot of sort of relinquishing of a public sphere or saying there's a fact but I don't understand it or I don't relate to it that way. Is that sort of what you were talking about just now? Is that a stance that you're...
All those quotes you gave, I think they feel like very honest admissions of, mm-hmm. of the possibility of knowing certain things. I mean, when I say the unemployment rate is 9.4%, I have no idea what that means. What I mean is I can't imagine what connection that figure has to the actual reality of the human experiences behind that number.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you told me how many people that stood in for, in quotes, that 9.4%, it's so beyond beyond the comprehension of one individual to be able to even understand what tens of millions of people's uncertainty and suffering and whatever it is, sadness, despair, you know, frustration, whatever are. So, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. I mean, the people who are in our constant public discourse, you know, whether they're politicians or people commenting on politics or all those of us just trying to make sense of what's going on, we constantly have to talk in these shorthand ways. And one thing poems can do is they can open back up our sense of our respect for the hugeness of experience and the mystery of experience.
Mm.
I feel that that is a public utterance that needs to be, that is important to say. I feel like it's important to speak that way when to say that you don't understand. I wish that politicians would say more that I don't understand what it means to be unemployed. You know, and some of them do, maybe. I think that's one thing that poems can do if we're just talking about the relation to public discourse at this point. But, you know,
is to leave a little bit of space for sort of a querulous human experience. That's
a lot of space for it. I mean, space, and the longer I live, the more I realize that how hard it is to understand, to really understand things. And I have a respect for other people's experiences and their lives. And I look at people walking around the street sometimes, and I think inside each one of these people is a giant galaxy of thoughts and emotions and ideas, feelings, and private thoughts that are private to others and private even to themselves. The world of the poem is that. I also write other types of things. I write critical essays, and if I want to make a point about something, convince somebody of some point or whatever, I'll be much more likely to write it in an essay than in a poem. A poem for me is opening myself up to the mysteries.
Well put. I think I wanted to ask you actually on that note to read Lamp Day, which is a poem that has a lot of space in it, a lot of that kind of imaginative space. Would you be willing to read that one?
Yeah, sure, of course. So interestingly, this poem, it begins with me remembering I went to graduate school in creative writing eventually at UMass Amherst. I came back to the Amherst area and lived in Northampton, and this memory of when I mentioned Summer Street is a street in Northampton that might be, and then I start thinking about more of a city environment. But, okay, Lamp Day. All day I've felt today is a holiday, but the calendar is blank. Maybe it's Lamp Day. There is one very small one I love so much I've taken it everywhere, even with its loose switch. On its porcelain shade are painted tiny red flowers, clearly by someone whose careful hand we will never know. Because it's Lamp Day, I'm trying to remember where I got it. Maybe it was waiting for me in the house on Summer Street I moved into almost exactly 17 years ago. I think without thinking, I just picked it up from the floor and put it on my desk and plugged it into the socket, and already I was working. So much since that moment has happened. On Lamp Day, we try not dreamily, but systematically to remember it all. I do it by thinking about the hidden reasons I love something small. When you take a series of careful steps to solve a complex problem, mathematicians call it an algorithm. It's like moving through a series of rooms, each with two doors. You must choose one. You can't go back. I begin by sitting on a bench in the sun on September 21st, thinking, all the walks I have taken in all the cities I have chosen to live in or visit with loved ones and alone, make a sunlit and rainy map no one will ever be able to hold. Is this important? Yes and no. Now I'm staring at clean metal girders. People keep walking past a hotel, its bright glass calmly reflecting everything bad and good. Blue boots, bright glass, guests in this moment. A child through the puddles steps exuberant, clearly feeling the power. I'm plugged in. I'm calm. Lamp Day has a name. Just like this cup that has somehow drifted into my life and towards which sometimes for its own reasons my hand drifts in turn. Upon it is written the single word, Omaha.
That's a poem that seems to have a lot of internal space and illumination and room for fantasy. I wanted to pick up on that topic that you just brought up about the place where the lamp was, which was Northampton, and ask you, you know, about your kind of your two visits to the Pioneer Valley. First, as an undergraduate, where you were a Russian major, which is very cool, and then your return when you decided much later, I mean, not at Amherst, you know, years after Amherst, that you were going to pursue not Russian but poetry in English. Can you talk a little bit about studying Russian and how you did and didn't connect to poetry at Amherst, and then what changed?
What happened, basically, is that when I went to Amherst, I think I was born in Washington, D.C., and I grew up in the D.C. area, and my father was a tax lawyer, and then my mother, she works at the Smithsonian now. My parents were part of this sort of political class that's very much a big part of the industry of Washington, D.C., so I grew up in politics, around politics and business. And so I went to Amherst. I think that my instinct was that I should study politics, political science, history, something in that area, that would be, there wasn't any, you know, explicit pressure from my parents. You know, I just felt that's the milieu I came from. So my freshman year, I, you know, took different classes. And it was also, it's important to remember that I came in 1985, which was the height of the Cold War, and we were all very afraid of nuclear war, and the Soviet Union was a looming presence for everybody, and it seems so old now to say that, but at the time it was present everyday fear. And so decided I was going to study Russian and study politics and try to maybe be a diplomat or some kind of, you know, person that would maybe be able to mitigate this situation. You know, it's the kind of idea you have when you're 18, and it was, you know, it's a nice idea. So I started studying Russian, and over the time I was at Amherst, I realized that, I was even going to write my thesis on politics, but my heart wasn't in it. So I switched to literature, and I had wonderful Russian professors, Taubmans and Stephanie Sandler, but mostly Stanley Rabinowitz was my main person there. And so he, of course, was happy when I decided I wanted to study literature instead. And so I ended up doing that. And my relationship to Russian was mainly through the language and the culture, eventually, and Russian literature. So I studied that. And then, to make a long story very short, I went the year after I graduated from Amherst. I lived in Moscow for a year on what was essentially the equivalent of a Fulbright fellowship. I had been nominated by the Amherst Russian department and got this fellowship. I lived there, and then I, after a few years of messing around, went back to graduate school to get a PhD in Russian and Slavic languages and literatures at UC Berkeley. But again, I just realized that what I really wanted to do was write, and so I ended up eventually back getting my graduate degree in poetry and from UMass Amherst, which has a very fine program. And I was thrilled to be back in the Amherst area. I love the landscape and the place, and so I feel very connected to it and close to it. So I felt like I was coming home in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So that's the short, hopefully not too long version of what happens.
Well, you were saying when we talked the other day on the phone that if anybody had told you that you would have been a poet while you were at Amherst, you would have been baffled by that notion.
Yeah. Well, you know,
how did you think about poetry then? Say a 20-year-old.
I mean, I liked it. I took some pretty good courses with David Sofield when I was there. Those were the only English courses I took, and I, you know, read some Russian poetry as part of my. I think I liked it, but I was much more into music and songs, like most people my age. And in fact, I wrote my senior thesis on a Russian folk singer who's sort of the Leonard Cohen / Tom Waits / kind of Bob Dylan esque figure in 1970s and 80s. Soviet Union, and so I was more interested in song and music. I'm also a musician, I play music, so I think that was, like, to the extent to which I was interested in what words could do in that area, it was through music. I just wasn't aware of contemporary poetry very much. It just wasn't something that I knew anything about. I mean, I suppose I knew intellectually that there were poets, but I didn't really know them or think of that as something that, you know, I would do.
When you started to write poems of your own, did you feel as if you pulled back on that Russian inheritance at all? Or, I mean, where did you go to figure out how to craft your own way in the world of making poems?
Really, I didn't really write poems. I mean, I'd written here and there a little bit and tried poems a few times, I think, just, I don't even know why, really. I think I just was drawn to it almost instinctively, but I'd never really seriously tried until I was in my first year of graduate school and I was at UC Berkeley studying Russian literature. And as I said, I realized pretty fast that I wasn't cut out to be a scholar. And I had always really wanted to write and be an artist, but I didn't know what kind of writing I would do. So I made myself sit down and write every day. And then what I started to write were poems, to my great amazement. I mean, they could have been stories or essays or I don't know what. They could have been anything. But they were poems. I think that was close to my heart without me knowing it. And, of course, I knew nothing. I didn't understand anything. So the only poems I'd ever spent any real time reading, studying, were Russian poems. And so the language of Russian, its syntax is so different from English language. The way that, without getting too technical, the way that information is conveyed, because English doesn't have cases for its nouns, it only has them for pronouns, I versus me or whatever. So you'd say Tom hit Harry or Harry hit Tom, and the only way you know who hit whom is by the word order. But that's not true in Russian. Russian has cases, so you know who hit whom regardless of what the order of the words is. So Russian is much more flexible in terms of its word order and syntax, and that word order and syntax can be used to convey emotional nuance. I was very interested in that and to what extent that was possible in English. And so my earlier poems, my poems from my first and second books, are more interested in material of language and what sort of uses it can be pushed towards. Mm. I think that's great, worthwhile, interesting experiments that came out of a genuine place. But then, you know, I think it was a long apprenticeship of learning and understanding my material, like any artist, sculptor, musician, you know, photographer, whatever, would learn to use his or her material. I was doing the same thing with words and with language.
Right.
I noticed that a lot of those poems that are now in Come On All You Ghosts actually have a really simple syntax. It's interesting that they begin with I'm staring, or I did this, I did that, kind of the Frank O'Hara mode, a little bit of almost deceptively simple. I'm staring out the window at an aluminum shed. I remember the house where I first lived. Mm. And this morning I rode my gray metal bike through the city. What is that person that's doing these sort of simple objects? Is that an autobiography? Who is that I accounting for there?
I mean, a lot of time it's autobiographical. It starts autobiographically. I mean, it'll come as no surprise to you, Tess, as a poet. If more interesting or better or more exciting to change the facts of what I was actually looking at or actually doing, or I will gladly change them. I'm not writing autobiography or memoir, but basically that's a guy in his 40s living in the city, you know, trying to be attentive. But, you know, I think, I mean, just going back to your question about simplicity, I know this is true for musicians. I mean, when you're learning to play your instrument, you can get, as you should, really into your instrument and playing and seeing what its possibilities are or whatever. But then the more mature you get, I guess, as an artist, the more likely you are to be able to convey powerful things in a much simpler, more direct, more subtle way, I guess. And so I think that probably this book is, in some extent, the product of a lot of hard work, of many years of hard work with my materials. It's easier for me, or I can see the possibilities more in a simple sentence and making slight adjustments or slight strangenesses.
Slight strangenesses. That's a great phrase. I really like it.
Yeah.
Slight strangenesses. I thought this is really great. And because you have so graciously been explaining your poetry to us, I wondered if you would read the poem in Come On All You Ghosts that begins, "Dear sociologists, I've been asked to explain poetry to you." And I thought we could finish there.
Sure.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Tess. You're great. Great questions, and it's an honor to talk to the Amherst community. I owe a big debt of gratitude to Amherst and to the professors I had and to my fellow students there. And Amherst is very often in my thoughts in the most positive ways. This poem, actually, it was a friend of mine who was a poet who was married to a sociologist, and she actually was writing about poetry, sociology in some kind of way, and she asked me if I would write something for this sociology conference I was going to. As I'm telling the story, it sounds so preposterous.
I thought it was going to be like a stance, but that really is autobiography.
No, it's true. So I just thought I would try, and the poem begins in that way, but then quickly
wanders, just like words.
And actually, I'll say just one other thing about it, which is that I was talking earlier about the Cold War and our consciousness in the 80s of the possibility of mass destruction. In the poem, I talk about the air raid siren going off. And when I was a kid in elementary school, we had an air raid siren in our schoolyard or whatever, and it would go off once a month, I guess, and we would all get under our desks, you know, in case of nuclear attack. I mean, that's how old I am. I mean, I'm not that old, but I mean, even into the 70s and 80s, people were doing this thing. So that actually pops up in the poem. But, okay, so this poem is called "You Have a Sounding Cosmic News." Dear sociologists, I have been asked to explain poetry to you. Thus, in the offices of Dazed Loop Press, the clicking begins. Lately, we've been conducting field experiments into our private thoughts. One faction next to the soul-shaped water cooler wonders whether there's any reason at all to remember the feeling of being a child. Is it best to imagine oneself again beneath the desk as the rusted air raid siren explodes with its bi-monthly ritual Wednesday afternoon fear distribution? Like you, I was always holding particular crayons in the dimness of certain morning assemblies. I have been told some of you think the only constant is constant observation. I know city planners designed the city, and still there are diffusionists who pace the deep blue edge of, do you know, you can never try to discover why flowers in the cubicles. Between you and me, the buildings also have a space for the sparrow named Never, who does not sing, yes, the cities die when you leave them. Yes, no one cares what you do. The glass-covered in dust windows of the thrift store display a mirror from the 1920s. If you take it, it will no longer regard young lovers with important thoughts pushed towards the mighty river. I will fall in love exactly about a million times, and then I will die. Clouds playing dominoes agree. At Everest on Grand, someone eats yak, discussing the endless undeclared war among the neutral provinces. Long, metallic, articulated girders cast thin shadows over thousands of windows. A photograph of a pacifist smiles. He wore a white suit, was a friend to the poor, and worked for the Union of Unemployed Telegraph Workers, who listened for signals pulsing, as Joni Mitchell never said, from the heart of a distant star. He was like my grandfather. After he died, the city fathers did not know what they were building when they built a museum to encase a window in a wall brought from a faraway country where it once overlooked the sea. Evenings, through giant speakers, people listen to troubled sounds. Whales bounce off continental shelves. Go tell everyone everything is related. The rich own the clouds, and you can always locate yourself with so many shadows to instruct you.
That's a lovely piece of daydreaming. Thanks very much. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me, and I'm really glad that we can share this with Amherst.
Thank you, Tess, and thanks to everyone for listening.